Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. As you have been hearing in the news, NSA leaker Edward Snowden has been granted asylum, a year's asylum, it seems, from Russia. He left the Moscow airport for the first time in over a month. He's going to like eating food other than the room service that was provided in his little hallway. We're going to talk about the NSA. That had been our plan, but let's top this with a conversation about what's going on about Snowden. We'll be talking with Karen Greenberg, head of the Center on National Security at Fordham. Hello, Karen.
Hi. How are you?
Are you surprised? I'm well. Are you surprised? Are you surprised that Snowden got asylum from Russia?
I'm a little bit surprised. It gives him a year in theory. But something had to happen to resolve the situation. I think this is probably the cleanest way, as he couldn't really find another place to go. I think this will affect and be on the agenda for Obama's meeting with Putin in September. So in a way, I think there'll be yet another we could see another resolution after that. But who knows?
I have this picture of the U2 pilot Francis Gary Powers walking across the bridge, and maybe we could have a version of that with but the opposite: Snowden walking across the bridge, being given back to the United States, and exchange for some, other concession.
Right. I mean, I do think the question of, what if it were reversed and there was somebody here that Russia wanted to try, and how that would play out, whether we would keep them and how we would explain it. It'll be interesting to see if any kind of formal explanation will come out from the Russian government or not.
Yeah. Do you think he's still dangerous in terms of more leaks that the United States government would find damaging?
Well, that's the word that those who are in touch with him, like Glenn Greenwald, have been saying. But I don't know if it's he that is dangerous, but whoever may have the material that he has. So, there's no way of knowing that, and I'm not sure that anyone knows, to tell you the truth.
And do you know if the Russia asylum puts him any closer to being able to travel, live, and get asylum in any of the other countries that have offered it, Ecuador or Venezuela, some country like that?
Again, I think that's more a matter of foreign policy than the machinations of Snowden in Russia with other countries. I think the United States is very much going to stay on top of this and try to control it. So I'm not sure that other than in a secretive and perhaps very protective way, any of that could happen more than it could have happened before.
Well, let's, you and I, leave the Russian airport, as Edward Snowden did, but we're going to Capitol Hill, where the NSA disclosed more information to lawmakers about their tactics. Yesterday, we learned more from The Guardian's Glenn Greenwald about the NSA's capabilities to access personal phone and email records. When Greenwald was on this show earlier this week, he said this.
For the first time since 9/11, Americans are now more worried about abuses of civil liberties than they are worried about terrorism.
That was from a Pew poll that found that 47% of adults have greater concern over the reach of U.S. anti-terrorism policies, and 35% said that they were concerned the anti-terrorism policies didn't go that far. When you factor in how many people had no opinion, it seems like no one is happy with the way things are currently going. Did you catch that poll? Do you think the change in public opinion is real and significant?
I think it's significant. I think it's not only that poll. There have been three or four polls that have been done over the course of the last month that have tried to assess Americans' feelings about what's been revealed in terms of the surveillance policies. And there has been a growing dissatisfaction. And even if there are people who continue to care about security and a small number who have weighed in one or more of these polls with still being concerned about security to the point where they think we need invasive surveillance policies, it's now starting to sink in to the American public and to the Congress what this actually means. When the news first hit of the Snowden leaks, there was a general sense reported throughout the media that what did it matter? We all kind of knew we were being surveilled. But, it's very different that when you sit down at your computer and think, wait, maybe I don't want to push on that search engine, and maybe I don't want to search that. And it affects behavior. And so it takes a while, I think, for the impact to sink in to individual citizens, and that's why I think this is what's happening with the polls, and I think it will increase, actually. And
well,
I think it is completely significant.
Beyond individual citizens and the polls, Congress, there's some momentum. There was an amendment that didn't pass but came close. I don't know how important that is. Sometimes legislation that doesn't pass, it's always championed by the guy who tried to pass it. But
no, I think
sometimes it is important.
Right. It is important because what it's showing you is that 12 years after 9/11, Americans, even Congress, you know, is struggling with the idea that maybe there is such a thing as too much in the name of security. And I think that the congressional almost passing that bill surprised people throughout Washington as well as in the country. And all you need for a change of mindset is enough traction so that you feel safe within your opinion and you're not just an outlier. And that's what's happening.
Right. So the way Glenn Greenwald talked about that poll is he said more people care about civil liberties than terrorism. I don't know if that poll literally shows that. I think perhaps the people want the right balance. So let's talk about that. I mean, no one is saying let's entirely scrap the NSA and let's allow any terrorists to chatter however they want. But what are the best ways to do this? What are the easiest reforms? Let's start with the low-hanging fruit, in your estimation, that should and could be done.
The low-hanging fruit seems to me to be the idea of introducing some kind of adversarial system when the issue for application for a warrant comes before the FISA court. So right now the way it works is that inside the Department of Justice, the preparation is done to apply to the court for the right to surveil. And what the Department of Justice says and what Jim Comey said last week when he was being confirmed for director of the FBI was, look, a lot of this adversarial process goes on inside the Department of Justice because of the standards of the FISA court. What's being proposed now is that that adversarial process take place in front of the court itself. And yesterday in testimony in Congress, I think two of the individuals said, one of whom had been a FISA court judge, said, you know, actually, that would make the process better and easier as a judge to determine.
Yes, that judge, I'm going to interrupt you by saying that judge was James Carr, and we actually have the exact clip. Here it is.
When the government proposed some new program, that it would have been useful to have somebody speak in opposition to the request and to sort of hear the other side.
Useful.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what we're going to get because it makes sense. And when somebody gets up and says, hey, we've had this court for decades, but there's never been somebody to talk about the side other than what the government's presenting, it's a staggering fact. And so I think that this, in essence, will happen. I think so that's one of the, I think, when you call it low-hanging fruit. And I think there are other ones as well. I think that there is going to be a sense that there has to be more transparency throughout the process of FISA, because what happened in this administration and in the administration before, but more in this one, is the president and his executive branch basically saying to the American people, you have to trust us. We're law-abiding lawyers. We know what we're doing. You have to trust us. But when the facts have been coming to the surface, and yesterday's being just another big revelation, as the facts come to the surface, it looks like the trust me idea of a presidency is not a reliable one.
Yes, I think America was sort of built on the idea of the rule of law rather than the rule of man. And our number is 212-433-9692. We're soliciting what's your opinion on the balance between security and privacy? Do you have any good ideas of where the lines should be drawn? What power should the NSA have? 212-433-9692. If you look at the statistics for the FISA court, you know, something like 11 denied government warrant applications out of 34,000, I mean, 99.97% or whatever that number works out to. That number alone, does that show that the FISA court is a rubber stamp? Because I know its defenders would say, you know, they pre-consult to make sure that all the applications are in order. But just on the face of it, should the FISA court be rejecting more applications?
You'd like to think so. And I understand that they say that there is a vetting process ahead of time. And I actually think there is. I don't think that's a smokescreen that they're hiding.
Yeah, and they can demonstrate that. I mean, there are statistics about the ones that have gone back and, you know, gotten approval. But sorry, go ahead.
Right. Right, but what I'm saying is, rubber stamp or not, it doesn't matter. What matters in setting up rule of law and setting up some form of transparency is having whatever you can have out in the open, and so it becomes, you know, and debated and considered, and that's why you need the adversarial process, whether it is a rubber stamp or not. You know, it just, if they could prove that it wasn't a rubber stamp, and I think they've made some good arguments in that direction, it doesn't matter. Having an adversarial process that is not just in-house allows for a broader consideration of any of the issues, and I don't think anybody would push back against that. I think the issue that was pushed yesterday in the hearing and that's going to come up again and again is transparency, and I think there has to be an understanding that transparency does not mean that sources and methods have to be revealed. I don't think that's what the ACLU and others are saying. Transparency means that the processes and the rules of the procedural rules have to be understood. And what Snowden's leaks have made clear is that the procedural rules were not clear.
Yeah. And we had a clip from her again earlier this week when Glenn Greenwald was on the show and talking exactly about the issue of transparency.
There's no question that I have access to all sorts of information about the NSA that members of Congress don't. Remember, it's been, I think, 6 weeks now since we published our first story, which is on June 6, revealing that the NSA was collecting the telephone records of every single American every single day for local and international calls, and has been doing this for several years, that the vast, vast majority of members of Congress had no idea that that was taking place. They were shocked that it was taking place.
Now, I don't even know if, Congress itself, as Greenwald says, and we'll go through this process, had a very hard time knowing about what programs. If a congressperson wasn't on the right committee, they wouldn't even know about these programs, and they wouldn't even know how to ask about these programs. And I don't know that just letting Congress know about them would be the definition of transparency. But it's at least translucence, you know? Are we getting closer to that, where your average member of Congress might be briefed about what his government is doing?
You know, I don't know. I think that's what the challenge is right now. Is this going to be and I think we are going to move in that direction because of this. I think that now that this is a national debate, now that people are paying attention, now that public officials like Keith Alexander are being asked to explain what they've done and to get through the murkiness for the American public, I think we will move towards, what did you call it, translucency, if not transparency. But I think there's going to have to be an awful lot of public education on the issue, and it is not something that this country has been good at or has been led well at in terms of understanding the balance between security and civil liberties, and I think that's where the challenge is going to lie.
Let's now go to Peter, who's calling from the Bronx. Peter, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. One question I never hear asked, which I believe should be the fundamental one, is what exactly is the nature of the threat that we're talking about in terms of giving up on various aspects of democracy? What are we facing? It's left as this kind of cosmic threat. I mean, is there going to be an invasion of the United States? No. Is there going to be a takeover from radical Muslims within the United States of the government? No. At most, we're talking about a few incidents where maybe 20, 30 people would be killed. I'm assuming that there's going to be greater security than in 2000, before 2001. That compares to 30,000 people being killed a year from guns, 45,000 or so dying because they don't have medical insurance. I mean, you have to measure the cost to democracy of government not being by the people and of the people, whether it's for the people, we can debate, versus what actually is the threat.
All right. Thank you for your call, Peter. And it does seem that perhaps the unstated, as Peter underlines, the unstated assumption is let's prevent another 9/11. That's what's driving everything, right, Karen?
Yeah, that is what's driving everything, and I think his question is exactly on point, and this is what I meant by education of the American populace, and to be able to think about this in real terms, in terms of what the threat is. You know, if the threat is climate change, this isn't going to help us. You know, what is the threat to us, and how do we understand it? Yesterday, in the hearing, the national security officials said that basically this program revealed really one terrorist to us, and that was Zazi, which was a serious plot against New York City. But the question is, they keep using the word haystack. Mm-hmm. You know, so the haystack seems to be everybody.
Yeah.
And it really makes you ask not just what is the threat, but how is it that more and more information is going to get you more and more specific intelligence if you don't actually know what you're looking for, what the threat is, and what the nature of the threat is. And so on a security level, forgetting a civil liberties level, on a security level, I'm surprised that more people aren't bothered by the idea that massive amounts of information are somehow in the hands of the government are somehow going to keep us safer.
And in fact, the government is warehousing all this information that it knows it can't get to, but perhaps if one day it can. And so there are reams and reams of data in storage facilities that apparently no one has ever combed through. But I do have a question about, you know, it seems that there's another side to that sword, which is, yes, disturbing as it is if the government surveils all of us, isn't it a danger if the government starts targeting in a bad way certain elements to surveil? Certainly they surveil people who, you know, they have strong suspicions, specific people, strong suspicions of being terrorists. But what if they don't throw the net over everyone? What if they only throw the net over, you know, Muslims, or only throw the net over recent immigrants, or conduct their business like that? That brings with it some problems.
No, that brings with it tremendous civil liberties problems, and that's why the closer the targeting gets to being about individuals who have shown some kind of cause or reason that the government should be following them, that's really what you want for your policy. And no, you don't want to be surveilling all Muslims or all, you know, males for that matter, between the ages of 17 and 25, which is, you know, the population that commits crimes generally, and that they worry about in terms of radicalization. So you don't want a surveillance system that massively profiles, and that is a concern. In terms of the data collection, I just wanted to mention one other low-hanging fruit that I think may become a reform, and mm-hmm. that is that General Alexander said last week at the Aspen Security Forum that when he was asked, well, what about if the companies just keep the information, and then when you want it, you subpoena the information.
Like Microsoft, Google, AT&T, those companies, yeah.
Facebook, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so, and his answer to that was that's possible. And since then, that's been said a number of times on the Hill. Yeah, that's a possibility we would consider. And I don't know what that means. I'm not sure it's as easy a Band-Aid as everyone thinks it is. But I do think this is one of the reforms that may happen, because it will be doable, and it will be doable quickly.
Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer, talking with Karen Greenberg of the Center of National Security at Fordham. So there's another key question, a distinction between having the power to access all this information and actually accessing the information. The NSA director, Keith Alexander, spoke at a Black Hat security conference. This is the gathering of the hackers. It was kind of brave of him to go there, I guess, in a way, though he is protected by men with guns. But he had the guts to get in front of these privacy advocates and say this.
And we get all these allegations of what they could be doing. But when people check, like the Intelligence Committee, they found zero times that's happened. And that's no bull. Those are facts.
Tough talk to the hackers. Do you buy that argument?
Yeah, no, I don't really understand. I mean, he addressed them last year, too. And when he addressed them last year, it was sort of like, and the same place he was going with this talk was, come and help us. Don't stand up to us. Help us to do this better if you want to criticize us. That's where he was going, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's sort of I think, yes, they'd like the talents of a lot of the people who understand the Internet and understand the intricacies of using it in ways that are, you know, unusual and unconventional. But I think it's more cosmetic than it is genuine. That's just my take on it.
Yeah. Well, it's not as if diplomacy is not a part of his job also. So my last question is sort of, you've been thinking about these issues all your life. Do you think, or at least all your professional life, do you think things are coming to a fore now? Is this a new conversation that we haven't been having for a long time, and maybe it's refreshing from where you sit?
It's absolutely, I don't know if I use the word refreshing, but it's profound and it's necessary. And Snowden catalyzed the conversation that we were going to have anyway. I think the American people now know for the first time what the authorities of the government are, even in a simplistic way. I think that they actually know who the officials in charge of this are for the first time. I think now there are names that are household names, whether it's Keith Alexander or Chris Inglis or whoever it is. They know these individuals, and now there is somebody to hold accountable and somebody for their representatives to engage with. And before, it's just been a morass a cloudy, without nameless sphere.
Yeah, and let me just throw this out because it just hit me. Yesterday we were talking to Fred Kaplan of Slate, and he detailed how serious the charges against Snowden might be. It just strikes me as remarkable that Congress is passing laws, the area of study that you have is radically changing, the public opinion has shifted so much. I think Snowden's got to be Time Man of the Year if they still have that. He had such a profound impact on so many aspects of society, and yet maybe one day we're going to lock him away for life.
Yeah, this is going to be a case that is going to bring passions from all different sides to the table. And, you know, by the book, it may be that he can be indicted and convicted if he returns to the United States. But it's taken on so much a larger sensibility, and all that will mean will have to factor in to what the Justice Department does, and there's going to be some very deep and long-term thinking about what the best, I hope, about what the best course will be, understanding this within the larger context of these transformations.
Karen Greenberg, head of the Center on National Security at Fordham University, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And coming up in a moment, what should the right wage be? Fast food workers organizing for higher wages, and we'll be discussing the landscape of minimum wage and living wage employment. Stay tuned.